Welcome to the Improv in Practice podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Wilson, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on improvised theater with Synergy Theater. You can find Synergy Theater's classes, workshops, performances, and more at synergytheater.com. That's S-Y-N-E-R-G-Y theater.com. Okay, lights down, curtain up. Hello, friends. It is July 5th, 2025, as I record this. We have a great episode for you, especially if you like Alfred Hitchcock, improvised theater, and the possibilities of modern technology. Our guest is Professor Dina Johnston, an instructor at San Francisco City College, writer, and film director. Professor Johnston teaches the films of Alfred Hitchcock, and we talk about Hitchcock's influences and enduring appeal as the master of suspense. Now, if you had the chance, what would you ask Hitchcock? We discovered a chatbot that impersonates Hitchcock, and with the cast of Synergy Theater providing the questions, we dove right in. The answers, perhaps like Hitch himself, were unpredictable, somewhat unreliable, and very entertaining. And if that weren't enough, what better way to honor live theater and Hitchcock's love of the macabre than to enable a Synergy Theater cast member to voice the answers? I'll reveal the cast member's identity in an aside at the end of the interview. Thank you, in order of appearance, to the cast for providing their questions. Adam, Eileen, Ben, Valerie, Griffin, Arastu, Ken, Adrian, and Lynn. Okay, on to the interview. Professor Johnston and Val, I'm so happy to get the chance to connect with you about one of my favorite things to talk about, which is, of course, improv. And I don't mind talking about Alfred Hitchcock either. Professor Johnston, I'm going to dive right in. Why Hitchcock?
Why not Hitchcock? I think Hitchcock was very much a man ahead of his time. He was always very interested in the dawning of new technologies when it came to film and its applications as a medium for entertainment, which was very contrary to many of his contemporaries, like Charlie Chaplin, for example, who, when early sound was being introduced in applications of cinema, he thought it was just a trend or a fad that was going to die out very quickly. So he actually refused to make sound motion pictures for many, many years. But Hitchcock, you know, he's definitely a prototype of a character and the embodiment, I think, of what many people think of as one element of being an auteur.
Mr. Hitchcock, I am a fan and an artist. I am painting a portrait of you, and I'd like to know which side of your profile do you prefer to represent yourself with, and why?
I'm flattered by your artistic interest in capturing my likeness. As a master of the macabre, I must say that I've always been quite particular about presenting myself in a certain way. Now, I know what you're thinking, my dear artiste. You're thinking, which side of his face should I paint? Well, I'll let you in on a little secret. I've always been quite fond of my profile from the left side. You see, when viewed from the left, my facial features seem to be in uniform, a bit like a symphony of shady characteristics. From my left, my eyebrows seem to be in perfect harmony with each other, like two symphonious spheres suspended in midair. And my nose, well, it takes on a rather sinister, almost curious shape, as if it's about to sniff out the next great cinematic thrill. But, my dear artist, remember, the key to capturing my likeness is to convey a certain sense of enigma, a certain air of mystery. I want my portrait to whisper to the viewer, come closer, and let me tell you a dark secret. So I leave it to your artistic discretion to decide which side of my profile to represent. But if I were to take a guess, I'd say you might want to consider. Yes, the left side. The side of darkness. The side of suspense. The side of me.
Hi, Alfred. This is Eileen, and I have a question for you. I wonder how it affected you psychologically, emotionally, to be a large man. And I wondered if you were insecure about being large, how you still felt confident about putting yourself into so many of your films in these cameos that you did. I'm just interested about your feelings about your own body. Thanks.
Ah, the obsession with one's physical appearance. How amusing. I've never allowed my physical condition to hinder my creativity or my altogetherness with my characters. As for the emotional turmoil, I've always maintained that one's appearance is but a mere facade, a thin veil that hides the true essence of the individual. My weight, you see, has become an integral part of my persona, a visual shorthand for the wit and cynicism that lies beneath. It's a facade I've wielded with great effect, if I do say so myself. One's body, after all, is a visceral experience, a lived-in canvas that has been scarred, stretched, and seasoned through the trials and tribulations of life. As for those cameos of mine, ha! Why, madame, I've always said that in every film there's a bit of the director peering out from behind the lens. It's a boast, a show of bravado, a knowing wink to the audience. And as for my visible presence in those films, why, that was always about adding a touch of the macabre, a je ne sais quoi that sets the viewer on edge, a reminder, if you will, that in the world of cinema nothing is as it seems. Now tell me, have you considered the psychological implications of being so fixated on one's physical appearance? Does the mirror reflect the true self, or merely a shadowy, trivialized version of it? I think we've only just begun to explore the labyrinthine corridors of the human psyche. Don't you agree, my dear lady?
What I thought made you a great candidate for this conversation was your work as a professor, and then also your work as a writer and director of your own material. I'm very interested in speaking with you about, during the course of your class, how do you speak to your students, or do you even bring it up that Alfred Hitchcock was very much a man of his time and had, I wouldn't say a very forward-thinking mindset when it came to women and their roles in cinema. And yet, many of the protagonists in his films were women. Do you speak to that? And if so, what do you say to your students?
You might have looked at the other classes that I teach. For example, this summer session, I'm teaching a class for the Women in Gender Studies department on women in film. I think there are a couple of things going on with him in terms of his centralizing of female characters, which honestly ran pretty contrary to what the mainstream of Hollywood was doing. And that comes later in his career. If you look at the 30s and going into the 40s, it's kind of all about like the wrong man. And the women are ancillary characters. And then as you go into the 50s and 60s, and he gets into his films like Psycho, and when things start getting weird, right? When you get to Vertigo in the late 50s, which is often regarded as the nail in the coffin of the classical film noir period. And then you go to 1960 with Vertigo, and then you go into The Birds. Like that period, things get really weird. And I think that that's for a number of reasons around not just changes with Hitchcock himself, but a significant shift in changes in the times in which he was living. Something that always strikes me when we get towards the end of his career is that he starts making missteps and miscalculations with scenes and scenarios that he feels very invested in being suspenseful and or deeply mysterious that he sees with test audiences secretly, of course, right? He's watching them, watching the film. And there's one scene that he shows to a test audience and they laugh when they're supposed to be in the throes of suspense. And that deeply impacted him when he felt not at the top of his game or like he was starting to be judged in some kind of way that wasn't in an appreciation, that was extremely difficult for him. He was a man who did not take rejection or a lot of criticism well.
If Alfred Hitchcock was immortal, how do you think he would have evolved if he had evolved through the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s all the way
Ooh.
to today?
I'm not sure that having that magic thing that he had would be eternally sustainable. If we think about the consciousness of and lived experience of somebody seeing the birth of cinema and being an active part of the formation in its infancy of like the formalization of narrative cinematic conventions, and then thinking about what he achieved throughout his career in terms of he was a lifelong reader of literature and just about anything written, right? Like from something in Reader's Digest to something in Vanity Fair to novellas to New York Times bestsellers and everything in between. The fact that he adapted all of his films from some other original source, whether it was news reporting or something loosely based on a historical event or figure like Jack the Ripper, for example, I'm just not sure that that kind of consciousness could continually evolve at such a rate of perfection. It's kind of difficult for me to imagine him in the contemporary world.
Hey Al, this is Ben Piper from Synergy Theater. What do you think of M. Night Shyamalan movies? And are there any other filmmakers from the last 25 to 30 years who have matched your level of expertise at being the master of suspense?
Ah, M. Night Shyamalan, the young master of predictability, I must say. While The Sixth Sense was a cleverly constructed tale, I always felt he relied a bit too heavily on the twist reveal, didn't he? Almost as though he thought that by itself it was enough to excuse the rest of the narrative. Ah, but perhaps that was the point. To show that suspense is more about setting up the expectation rather than delivering on it. As for The Happening, oh, well, I think that film is a perfect example of what happens when one confuses clever plot twists with genuinely frightening cinema. The marketable shock of a sudden collapsing cornstalk doesn't quite sustain an entire film, if you ask me. Ah, but I suppose it's a comforting thought, knowing that audiences are still capable of being sold such fleeting artificial thrills. As for other filmmakers who match my level of expertise, ah, now that's a tall order. Within the last quarter century, few have managed to capture the essence of suspense as I did in my day. However, a few names do stand out. David Fincher, for one, has a chilling sense of atmospheric tension that borders on the unsettling. The Darkening, Seven, Fight Club, all exemplary in their mastery of mood and deliberate pacing. And then, of course, there's David Kruger, a master of modern-day macabre, with films like Someone to Watch Over Me and Obsession. Well, not entirely comparable to my typically darker and more fantastical fare, his tendency to subvert expectations while still allowing his characters to fall prey to fate. That's where his strength lies.
I think that he would have been really fascinated by filmmakers like David Lynch, because Lynch embodied a lot of mystery, but he was the total opposite of Hitchcock because he thought that it was totally useless for him to explain his movies to people, which is something that Alfred Hitchcock did incessantly. I think that Hitchcock would be very intrigued by that approach.
Mm. If you could ask Alfred Hitchcock anything, what would you ask him?
I would have a couple of questions for him, but I think I would be very curious to hear him talk about what kind of impact he felt that working in Germany, in Berlin, during the German Expressionist period, the impact retrospectively that he saw that had on his filmmaking and his prioritization of this cardinal rule in filmmaking of making film is to show and not tell. There's some really great dialogue in Hitchcock films, but predominantly it's about what he's showing you and the view, the vast or limited view that he allows the viewer, and when and how he chooses to give his viewer more information than the characters at hand. I really would be interested in hearing a reflection on what early experience in filmmaking that he had made the biggest and the longest impression on him and the way that he ultimately ended up making films.
Well, I have the chatbot up that that is going to impersonate for us Alfred Hitchcock. And I have typed in your question. Alfred's thinking about it. And here we go. Okay, I'll read it verbatim from the chatbot. I wish I had a British accent. This is the answer. Yes, my sojourn in Berlin and Vienna during the Weimar era. Am I saying that correctly?
Weimar.
Weimar era. It was chaotic, tumultuous time, wasn't it? The world was reeling from the aftermath of the Great War, and the old order was crumbling. I was a young man, barely out of my teenage years. The experience had a profound impact on me, I must confess. It was there that I developed a deep fascination with the darker aspects of human nature, with the blurred lines between reality and fantasy. I was drawn to the works of expressionist writers who chronicled the disintegration of societal norms. But, of course, it wasn't just the intellectual currents that shaped me. It was the atmosphere itself. Berlin in the 1920s was a city on the edge, a city of crumbling facades and hidden secrets. It was the perfect breeding ground for a young man with a fascination for the macabre and the unusual. And it was there that I discovered my love of film, the art form that would become my life's passion.
Interesting.
What do you think?
I definitely see the interest in and his heavy leaning into exploring humans' moral gray areas. This is a guy who lived in his life through World War I, World War II, which he was actually one of the last European filmmakers, if we want to include England in that, to emigrate to the United States. There were several from German filmmaking. There were tons of cinematographers. Hollywood was built on the back of the emigration of all of those directors and writers and producers and set designers who really amped up the visual and subtextual game of Hollywood. I think that it paints in broad strokes the deep kind of impact that that had. And being in Weimar era Germany, that had to be incredibly mind expanding for a young British guy who was raised in a pretty strict household in terms of sexuality and expression.
Val, if you could ask Alfred any question, what would it be? And while you're thinking, I will say that I would ask Alfred what he would think about improvised theater. I don't see him liking or leaning toward improvisation in his own work, but I like to imagine that if he was able to sit in the Lesher Center and watch one of Synergy Theater's improvised plays, I think he would be inspired and would really enjoy it, but also be kind of scared by it. Val, do you have your question for Alfred?
I just looked this up because did he actually do a comedy? I don't know much about Hitchcock. So I'm curious about The Trouble with Harry, which says it's a 1955 black comedy film by Hitchcock. Just wondering what made him change to that or the inspiration, I suppose, because typically I don't think people think of comedy in Hitchcock.
Professor Johnson, do you know anything about that film?
Yeah, that was like the mid-50s. Shirley MacLaine is in that film, if memory serves. And actually, Val, there's quite a bit of comedy embedded in Hitchcock. I would say he errs on very much on the side of dark comedy, though. Like the 40s film Shadow of a Doubt, for example, which also would classify as noir. There's a lot of that kind of macabre humor. These two guys, whenever they get together, they've read their recent like true crime magazine that they like picked up at the store, and they have this contest to figure out who can come up with the best way to murder somebody and get away with it, which is so comical to be like super serious about it and like talk about this very inappropriate thing in like a family sit down dinner setting, for example.
Hello, Mr. Hitchcock. This is Valerie. I would want to know, what is your drink and dinner order at an Italian restaurant?
I'm a man of refined tastes, and I must say I have a weakness for the finer things in life, including, of course, Italian cuisine. My drink of choice, I must confess, is a fine glass of Chianti. No, not just any Chianti, mind you. I am rather particular about my wine. I want it to be full-bodied, with just the right amount of acidity and tannins. And of course, it must be served at the perfect temperature. Anything less would be simply unacceptable. And now let us proceed to the dinner order. Ah, yes, I think I shall have the usual. You know, just a simple yet elegant feast of contention and suspense. Pardon me, my dear friend. Oh, yes, my dinner order. Well, I shall have the filet mignon cooked to perfection with a side of garlic amporna and sautéed capers. And, of course, a nice riposte of iceberg vegetation, eh? Not just any iceberg, mind you, a special alpine herb from the Tuscany region, renowned for its unparalleled fragrancy and definitive nuances.
I think there are different kinds of comedy, and some comedy comes out of the failures and sometimes miseries of heterosexual couplings or romantic irony, as it's referred to, Hitchcock's romantic irony, which deeply resonates with a lot of people who have been a part of an unrequited love situation or a wrong time, wrong place, but you thought it was the right person kind of situation, where his characters are like ships passing in the night and there's a very intense attraction and like a desire to make a thing work that will never work for reasons that can't really be explored. Sometimes it's because you were the daughter of a Nazi and you decide to work for the United States government and go to Brazil and then play a double agent and put your life in jeopardy. As my favorite Hitchcock film, Notorious, with Ingrid Bergman and Cary Grant.
Mr. Hitchcock, I'm at the airport right now and I need to decide on a location, a destination. to get out of the public eye for a while where no one could find me. Where's the best place in the world to fly to where I won't be found?
My dear, I think I know exactly what you're after. A secret getaway. A place to lay low and avoid the prying eyes of the paparazzi. Or, in your case, whoever might be looking for you. I've got just the place for you, my friend. The Azores Islands, located in the middle of the Atlantic. Over 1,000 miles west of Europe. It's a virtual island paradise with its lush green landscapes, hot springs, and crystal clear waters. You'll be able to breathe a sigh of relief and relax in peace. But don't be fooled, my friend. The Azores are not without their secrets. The islands have a rich history of smuggling, piracy, and even used to be a hideout for pirates. The islands are sparsely populated, and the locals are a tight-lipped bunch. You'll be able to keep a low profile and avoid detection. Of course, there's always a catch, my friend. The Azores are a bit of a trek to get to. You'll have to fly from a major airport to Ponta Delgada, the capital of São Miguel Island, and then look to transfer to a smaller plane to reach the other islands. But trust me, it'll be worth it. And who knows, my friend? You might just find yourself entangled in a web of intrigue and deception. But that's a risk you'll have to take. After all, as I've always said, the main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. And the main thing is to keep you safe.
You know, like, that plot sounds kind of ridiculous. But if you see it, it's one of these most, like, grand, sweeping, romantic things that you'll ever see in your life, which seems impossible by the way that I've described it.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about the absurdity of some of the stories and the situations that the characters get themselves into. Yes, absurd is a good word to use, but as you're watching it, you're squirming because you're totally in the moment with these characters. It's believable. You are there, you are living it. And to you, it's a, as an audience member, I'll speak for myself, but I'm watching this and a part of my brain knows it's absurd. But the other part is like, oh my gosh, I could totally see myself in this situation, right? And feeling the same. That's a magical thing that he did accomplish. He took, in each of his films, you could argue this, he took an absurd situation and made it believable and then pulled all of those emotions out of his audience as though they would be in that situation with those characters in that film under that plot. That's incredible, really, when you think about it, don't you think?
Yeah, the investment that he got from his audiences, I think, in a couple of ways is perhaps unparalleled by many of his contemporaries working in Hollywood.
Hello, Mr. Hitchcock. My name is Arastu Darakshan, and I am curious to know which three virtues are best for anyone to have.
Ah, I'm glad you asked. As a filmmaker who has spent his career probing the human psyche, I've come to believe that there are three virtues essential for anyone to have in order to navigate the complexities of life. First and foremost, it's essential to have a sense of curiosity. We must be willing to question, to seek out answers, and to explore the unknown. It's this curiosity that drives innovation, that fuels creativity, and that allows us to push beyond the boundaries of what's possible. Secondly, one must possess a sense of self-awareness. Ah, yes, the ability to know oneself is a rare and precious gift. It's this self-awareness that allows us to recognize our motivations, our desires, and our fears. And it's only through this understanding that we can begin to navigate the treacherous waters of human relationships. And finally, my dear friend, it's essential to cultivate a sense of resilience. For life is full of surprises, of twists and turns, of triumphs and tragedies. And it's only through our resilience that we can weather the storms, that we can bounce back from adversity, and that we can emerge stronger and wiser on the other side. Ah, yes, these three virtues, curiosity, self-awareness, and resilience, they are the keys to unlocking the secrets of the human heart, and they are essential for anyone who wishes to navigate the complexities of life with clarity, courage, and conviction.
That brings me back to what we were talking about earlier about his evolution. It makes me even more curious how he would have evolved had he been immortal. And I did ask a question as we were talking about how Alfred felt about improvisation. It's a great answer, and I'll read it to you guys. It's short. Improvisation, my dear fellow, a subject that sends shivers down the spines of many a director. I, myself, have always been a stickler for the script, for the carefully crafted story that I had poured my heart and soul into. While I appreciate a well-executed surprise or an unexpected nuance, I must confess that I find improvisation to be fraught and potentially disastrous undertaking.
That's believable.
Yeah. I think that resonates. Yeah. Now we have other questions, and I actually want to see what answer we get when we type in a question about the trouble with Harry. So Val, going back to your question, how would you phrase that to Alfred?
I guess I was just curious what inspired him to make the trouble with Harry. I didn't know he did so much dark humor or comedy. Never thought of him and comedy together.
Okay, let's see what Alfred says. Okay, here it goes. Ah, The Trouble with Harry, a film that has always been a bit of a misfit, a curmudgeon, well, a bit of a problem child in many ways. You see, I was approached by Paramount to make a comedy, a lighthearted, frivolous vehicle, a departure from the serious works I'd been producing. I must admit, I was intrigued by the prospect of making a film that was more mischievous, shall we say. A story that poked fun at the formalities of life, that probed the edges of mortality with wit and charm, rather than the usual weighty moralizing. The idea for the film grew from a series of comedy short stories by Arthur Kober. I was captivated by the ingenuity of the plot, the way it slid between slapstick antics and clever social commentary. It was a rare experience for me to be able to relax and simply enjoy the process without the weight of creating something monumental or deeply psychological. Well, I believe that he did have a good time making that film and that he did recognize it as a departure from what he was typecast, maybe I would say, as a director. Now, we have other questions from the cast of the upcoming Spontaneous Hitchcock that Synergy Theater will perform at the Lesher Center for the Arts here in July. And we are going to ask Alfred, our chat bot, and we're also going to ask Professor Johnston. Val, would you like to read one of the questions? And Professor Johnston, while she's looking up the question and choosing the one she wants to ask, tell us about your exposure to improvised theater.
Well, my coming of age in undergrad, I had a background in a little bit of the performing arts and a deep entrenchment in the fine arts. And then there started to be quite a few crossovers between them. I had quite a few friends during that time who were modern dancers. And in much of their work, that relied heavily on improvisation, especially in their process of choreographing their own work, as well as some of the dancers that they were studying. I'm not sure that I've ever attended an improv performance per se, but I have a lot of interest in improvised techniques, especially in art making. That's the way that I go about my process from some of my own film making to even some of the ways that I approach writing essays and other things.
Based on your chosen form of art and how you've traveled and the courses that you teach, I humbly suggest that you would really enjoy it. I don't know if you're familiar with Synergy Theater and how they operate, but the performers, the core cast, improvise a full-length play from beginning to end. And they are so highly skilled in doing this, they'll take a theme like Alfred Hitchcock, the films of the theme of Hitchcock, and they will work inside that theme. They'll take audience suggestions during the performance, and they'll bring in recognizable elements from Vertigo or any of the other really popular films, The Birds. And it is by far one of Synergy's most popular shows. The tickets sell out at the Lesher, and audiences just love it. Wouldn't you say, Val?
Yes, in fact, I was one of the ones who voted that he do Hitchcock again when we were trying to decide what to do for the 24-25 season, because it's like a sure thing. We just know audiences love Hitchcock. It's timeless. I think I'll just read Ken's question first.
Okay.
And Ken is the artistic director.
Hi, Alfred. This is Ken Adams, the artistic director of Synergy Theater. I heard you are a notorious practical joker. What's the best practical joke you ever pulled on somebody?
He would probably say something like, the art of the practical joke is quite interesting. It's suspense's cheeky cousin. I was quite a mischief maker in my day, and one of my more devious jokes or pranks was pulled on the set of filming the 39 Steps. He handcuffed the two leads, Robert Donat and Madeline Carroll, together for a scene, and then just lost the key for hours. And in doing so, right, this is one of those kind of like mean director tricks that you hear about later, to put certain thoughts or ideas or feelings into the actors that then can be utilized and honed and focused for the desired outcome ultimately in their performance.
Ah, yes, the art of the practical joke. Well, I do love a good deception, and I've had my fair share of tricks up my sleeve. But I suppose one of my favorites, my pièce de résistance, if you will, was when we wrapped filming The Birds. I had the props department create a beautiful cake for Tippi Hedren. However, when she cut into it, a live seagull emerged, causing quite a shock and laughter on set. Of course, I'm no stranger to having practical jokes played on me. In the lead up to filming Mr. and Mrs. Smith, I had stated in a press release that all actors should be treated like cattle. In response, Carol Lombard arranged for a pen to be built on set. When I arrived on the first day, there were three cows inside wearing name tags of my leading cast.
If you watch or rewatch the 39 Steps, the scenes where they're handcuffed together, early on, it's total panic. And then you can see as it drags on because they have no way to remove the handcuffs. So even when they're not filming, they are handcuffed together and have to literally figure out how to do things. That you can see that manifest in a later scene when they made it through the fields and escaped these guys that were trying to take them back to the bad guy to do bad things to them. They've made it to an inn and are pretending they're a married couple. Robert Donat is trying to prove how tough he is to her all the time, but then he offers to put her wet stockings to hang them up in front of the fire so that they'll dry. So he created this understanding and sense of resilience in his actors by placing them in that situation for so long that they had to come up with creative ways of doing things and thinking about what it is to actually be in that situation as those characters.
I heard that he did do that, and I just love that story. It's torturous, but also very funny.
Well, and that's a nice one. I think that comes very much out of his deep Britishness. Also, the practical joke seems very much to me to be a way to excuse engaging in that kind of behavior in the first place. An interesting guy.
Very. Okay, Val, you want to ask our next question?
I'll do Adrian's. Again, a short question. Should be interesting.
Mr. Hitchcock, this is Adrian. I recently discovered I'm a big fan of yours. So I heard that you acquired a very unique pet, and that you acquired that unique pet in a very, very strange way. Could you tell me more about that? Thank you very much.
Which pet? Which pet? Perhaps it would be his unusual pet raven named George Thomas, gifted to him by the crew after they wrapped the birds. He had quite a personality. He was moody, majestic, and more professional than some actors he's directed, perhaps. He lived in his office and would occasionally caw during meetings as if offering editorial commentary.
Ah, my dear friend, I think I see where this is going. You want to know about my pet, don't you? Very well, I'll tell you a secret. My pet is a creature of the night, a being of mystery, of terror, of suspense. But I fear I must keep its true nature a secret, even from you. After all, a filmmaker such as myself must always maintain a level of unpredictability. But I will say this: my pet is a companion, a confidant, a partner in the creation of terror, and one day I may just release it onto the world.
Oh, I like that answer. What do you think that's real? Could be a hallucination.
It could be, but interesting.
And George Thomas was the crow's name?
Yeah, I think so.
Let's see if we can find something. Let's see if it'll
I think it
say.
might be the one in those pictures with him and Tippi Hedren.
Okay. Well, chat says George Thomas, the crow. Ah, yes, a most singular and fascinating subject, I assure you. George, as he was fondly known, was a remarkably intelligent crow who lived in the garden of my country home, Northwood. It was a pleasure to observe him, to follow his autumnal exploits, as he would tirelessly search for seeds and treats amidst the leaf litter. But what intrigued me most about George was his ability to mimic phrases and words. It was as if he had a bit of the philosopher in him, that he was attempting to grasp the intricacies of human language, to concoct little seditious phrases that would drive me to distraction. This is
It's
nuts,
totally
Dot. Yeah,
hallucinating.
totally. Oh, I love it. Yes. Well, that's wonderful. I hadn't heard about George Thomas before. That's a wonderful bit of knowledge. I hope Adrian, who is a fantastic cast member of Synergy Theater and is known for his character work and his manipulation of his form on stage, he can improvise any life form that you can think of and does it incredibly well. I hope that satisfies Adrian's question. Val, do you want to ask the next one?
Yes, this is from Lynn.
Hey, Hitch, is it true that your wife Alma was really the brains behind Psycho and that she writes all your material?
I think, as he said when he got the AFI Lifetime Achievement Award, that he honestly shared it with her. He had to thank three people. He said, "My writer, my editor, and my cook." Alma Hitchcock, I still think, is very underappreciated and under-acknowledged as a continual and seminal force throughout Hitchcock's filmography. He didn't have the nerve to ask her out until he had a higher position at the film company that they worked at than she did. He felt a sense of duty in some way, or that he had to be more successful than she was. And it was quite early on when she stopped getting on-screen credits for her work. But she was always reviewing pages of the script. She was the last word. He would get her counsel on everything. And he would hardly, if ever, do anything without Alma's sign-off on it. I'm not sure that he would ever say that she had done it all. I think that he would say that he couldn't have done it without her, though.
Yes, I agree. And okay, it took it a while to come up with this answer, and that is, Alma, my talented and long-suffering collaborator, the brilliant designer, costumer, editor, writer, and researcher behind many of my films. Ah, Alma, my dear Alma, the one who kept me in line, who kept my feet on the ground, who kept me from succumbing to my more exacting tastes. Alma, I must confess, was the project manager, the idea woman, the behind-the-scenes genius who saw my notions through to fruition. While I concentrated on crafting the overall concept, the atmosphere, and the tone of a film, Alma worked tirelessly to bring it all together, to imbue it with a sense of puzzles and erratic parallel growth, whatever that means. Your response to this, Professor Johnson, is definitely on target. And I would like Alma to get more attention today and more credit today than she did in the past. Professor Johnston, do you have any questions for us regarding improvised theater?
I would be very keen to experience it. That concept of doing a totally improvised play from beginning to end seems insane to me. But at the same time, a loose structure would clearly be key to that, right? You kind of need a beginning, a middle, and an end, or these places by which you've achieved certain things. So having a seasoned cast with an array of talents can certainly get you there, I'm sure.
Yes. Ken Adams is the director, and this is the core of what he teaches in his classes, and that is the structure behind improvising a full-length play. I right now have the privilege of being in one of his classes, and that is precisely what we're doing. Every scene has a structure, and then scene by scene by scene, you advance per this structure throughout the play, throughout the arc of a play. And it is surprisingly easy, and also one of the hardest things that I have ever challenged myself with. It stokes your creativity. You have to think with at least two minds about everything you're doing, but then also just letting your creativity bloom. One of my favorite principles is your partner is always right. If you are in a scene with someone and they have an idea, as their partner, one of your jobs is to make your partner look good by yes-anding their ideas. It's incredible. It's wonderful. And with the theme of Hitchcock, the cast really does appreciate the premise of suspense and shared common fears of how it is just to be a human. What set Alfred Hitchcock films apart were that the fears that were being shown, explored in many of his films, were complex fears of abandonment. Please name some more, Professor Johnson.
Parental disapproval, fear of not fitting in, the fear of rejection, the fear of not being loved or capable of love. I mean, it goes on and on with Hitchcock.
Yes, it does.
What isn't a fear?
Right. Anything that a human truly fears would make its appearance in a Hitchcock film. One of the things that Synergy Theater and the core cast do so well is to bring the emotion and the human heart into each one of their plays. They're very aware of how important this is to engage the audience. Yes, many of the plays are comedic. There are lighthearted moments, but the cast is always looking for that way to hook the audience emotionally and make them care about the characters. They know that the way that you get the audience engaged is to get them hooked in their emotions. Every time I watch a Synergy Theater improvised play, I look for it, and they always deliver. Wouldn't you say, Val?
Yes. And you know that I go to every show.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the mother. I'm a mother of one of them. And I decided in 2018 that I didn't want to miss any more shows. So I've been going to pretty much 32 shows every year.
And you're also the filmographer. You record.
I record each. I take photos. So they don't really have a marketing person. They're nonprofit, small budget. So I do this voluntarily. And I, thank goodness, I enjoy it because I see so many shows. So that's the brilliant part of improv is I never see two of the same show.
And Professor Johnson, thank you again so much for taking the time to meet with us. And I am so grateful for you sharing your knowledge with us and your experience. And I would like to invite you, if you would like to come and bring your whole class to see one of Synergy Theater's shows. Now, how can people get in touch with you if they want to, if they're interested in collaborating with you or interested in what art you are producing now? How would they find you and where would they find your work?
Sure. For my own personal work that I do outside of school, I have a website. It's just dinajohnston.com. You can find out a bit more about me there. For those interested in the classes that I'm teaching at City College of San Francisco in the cinema department, you can just Google CCSF Cinema. That should take you to our homepage. And then in the upper right, there's links to the current and upcoming semester class schedules. Or you can click on my name and that has more information about me.
Wonderful. And then in closing, this is probably not a short answer. If there was someone out there who had not been exposed or had not experienced a Hitchcock film and did not really know anything about Hitchcock as a director, what recommendation would you give them?
Oh, that's hard because I want to say like you at least need to see like three or four films, but I guess it really starts with one. And I mean, the great thing about his filmography is he's one of those filmmakers that continued a strong career starting in silent cinema. So if you're a fan of or are potentially interested in silent cinema, he has earlier fledgling works that start to breadcrumb things that will become recurring themes and obsessions for him throughout his career. For silent cinema, I think The Lodger from 1927 is a really good one to look at, loosely based on a Jack the Ripper scenario. For his early sound work, the 39 Steps, a little spy espionage with the good old red herring of Hitchcock thrown in there to get you off track of what's really important or going on in the film. And then I think that this might be changing, but for a really long time, The Lady Vanishes, which was one of his last films that he made in Great Britain before coming to Hollywood to make films, has long been the number one fan favorite of early Hitchcock films. Then he comes to Hollywood. He works with David O. Selznick, who was fresh off his wins from Gone with the Wind. And he makes Rebecca, which is with Joan Fontaine and Laurence Olivier. And that is such a anti-Hitchcock film that it has to be seen to be believed. Just this idea that there's a female character linking back to what we talked about earlier about, you know, his treatment of women in his films. The main character doesn't even have a name in that film, Joan Fontaine's character. The only one getting talked about is Rebecca, who's like dead and you never even see her except for in a painting. Then the list just keeps going on and on. You like film noir, you need to see Shadow of a Doubt. Joseph Cotten is the creepiest that he probably ever was in his whole entire career, playing very against type as a weird serial killer. And then Notorious, which I mentioned is my favorite film. I want to tell everybody to start at Notorious, but that's just unrealistic. The great thing about Hitchcock is there's a film that he's made for everyone, and maybe it's just in your journey to finding that film.
Oh, I like that. You've made me think of a follow-up question for you, and that is, if someone could, without having watched any of the films, look at Alfred Hitchcock and think to themselves, oh, he's so old-fashioned. These films are all so old. What would you say is their long-lasting, perpetual draw?
Well, I think Hitchcock, it's really steeped in his well-earned moniker of the master of suspense. There was a documentary film made using a collection of interviews between filmmakers, some of whom you might not even think had actually been influenced in any significant way by Alfred Hitchcock. Like, Wes Anderson is in there and he's like, Hitchcock is one of my biggest inspirations. That's always super interesting to me to learn about artists and filmmakers and writers and who had deeply influenced them and to hear them talk about the film, the painting, that play, etc., that got its hooks in them and opened their mind to new ways of seeing and doing things. That documentary film, I think, is maybe even a really good place to start, because the way that somebody might talk about how Hitchcock changed the horror genre with Psycho, for example, I think Eli Roth is interviewed in that. And so he's doing films like Saw and like Hostel. Horror movies, but one of his biggest inspirations is Alfred Hitchcock, and you understand that better when you hear him talk about it. They play clips or these precise moments that are being discussed, and it all comes together in this great tapestry.
Thank you again so much for your time. And Val, do you have a final question for Professor Johnson?
I just want to say thank you so much for teaching Hitchcock. I appreciate that, and long live Hitchcock. Just keep
Yeah.
teaching him on and on for generations.
That's right. And I do hope that you come to a show. I think that you would really enjoy
Please
it.
come as our guest. I'll get your ticket.
Yeah.
Just let me know which date.
I will definitely let you know. Thank you so much for the invite to join you for this discussion and to come and see live improv theater. Long live live improv theater. And I think Hitchcock will be around for a long time, as should improv.
Yes. All right. Thank you, Val. Thank you, Professor Johnston. And I hope to see you both at the Lesher Center for Synergy Theater's improvised Hitchcock show. And before you go to get your tickets to Synergy Theater's improvised Hitchcock, opening July 17th, 2025, at the Lesher in Walnut Creek, California, let's reveal the cast member who graciously lent us his time to voice our Alfred, Ben Piper. Thank you, Ben. Also, I have a parting note. After our interview, Professor Johnston emailed to say that the bit about George Thomas, the crow, was untrue and a hallucination from ChatGPT. It was Professor Johnston's prank in Ode to Hitchcock, which our Alfred then hallucinated about. Is it just me? Or do you also feel like the more entwined we become in the virtual, the more we should value the authentic and in person? On that note, I hope to see you in the audience at Synergy Theater's next show.
It was a pleasure speaking with all of you. And until next time, good night.
And that's our show. If you think improv sounds like fun, it is. If you think you'd like to try improv, it's easy. Just go to synergytheater.com and click on School of Improv. Synergy Theater offers beginner, advanced, and master classes. Synergy Theater is also on Facebook. Please rate, review, and follow this podcast. Your support makes a difference. Synergy Theater is a 501c3 tax-deductible nonprofit that depends on the participation of current and future star supporters and improvisers like you. Thank you.